Hi, and welcome to CX for CA, the podcast that focuses on customer experiences and especially how they're orchestrated in emerging economies. We've got just a fantastic guest today. Sunny Landeros is a prestigious CMO in many organizations here in the Middle East. And she's got some great anecdotes today. For example, she tells the story, of course, about the cappuccino machine and Pierce Brosnan and the campaign that went viral, the best $3,000 she ever spent, as she says. But she also just got great insights. She talks really interestingly about how moving to somewhere like the Middle East from America made her a real global marketer. She says that before she came to the Middle East, she thought she was a global marketer, but in fact, she was just translating content, which I just think is a great line and really resonates. She talks about her experience marketing to high net worth individuals, from transferring skills from marketing cosmetics to marketing private aviation, how people are different, how people are the same, the role of education and on a career, what was a troubled and startup for her early in her career, and the role of the entrepreneur in business. And she made an incredibly interesting, powerful, and emotive, I thought, argument for why the Middle East is just a great place for women to build a career, and how the culture and the way that society is structured here really allows a much better work-life balance for women attempting to build a career. And I just thought that was just really interesting and just a case really worth making. I really hope you enjoy this conversation as much as we enjoyed recording it. Sunny was just a fantastic guest, and I'll leave you now in her capable hands. So Sunny, hi and welcome.
Thank you.
So I wanted to start off by asking a really obvious question, which is, now you're at the top of your profession in terms of marketing, but originally you're an all-American Texas girl. And I really wanted to sort of start off by asking about, how you came to live in the Middle East and what you found, what you expected to find, and what actually you discovered in terms of, working here.
It's been such an incredible journey, and I never imagined in my life that I would have been here, and I would be here for almost 9 years now. When I grew up, on 1,500 acres in Texas on a horse farm, and I grew up in jeans and a cowboy hat and high school cheerleader and the whole Americana like theme. I had no idea that, fast forward a couple decades, I would end up in the Middle East, marketing aviation and all sorts of other things, especially geared around high net worth individuals and working with such a diverse group of people. When I first thought about moving to the UAE, I actually didn't know what to expect. I always thought of the Middle East as kind of this uncharted territory. And even though we grew up with Arabian horses and training them, my mom would come to Saudi a lot. I never actually worked here. I never experienced life here. I didn't understand the culture. And I saw people as so distant from me as like this Texas girl. And now when I came here, I found the most welcoming community I've ever found anywhere in my life. And not just from a professional standpoint, but from a personal standpoint as well. And I love that every holiday around the world is celebrated here with groups of people always getting together. And usually for Thanksgiving, when I celebrate Thanksgiving, I have 16 to 20 friends, none from the same country. They all bring dishes. We all talk, and it's my holiday, but I get to share it with so many different people. And I think it's made me, in a professional capacity, I think it's made me so much better. In the US, I am a typical American in the sense that I grew up, I went to school, I learned how to market, and I thought I knew everything. I thought that I was global marketing because I worked for a company that was global. And really, we were just translating content. We had no idea what actually sparked interest in the Middle East, in Asia, in Russia, even in Europe. US and Europe is not the same. It's, even though they're two Western-minded countries, it's very different. And so it was really starting to actually understand that and having teams with me that were so diverse that one person would stand up and say, I don't understand that message, and you'd have to change everything because that person was actually relevant to the country that I wanted to market to.
And how do you go about understanding that? Because you say whatever culture you're from, you can really only understand that culture and maybe have some idea about others. So is it the case that what you're looking to do is to sort of, you know, have a team of different cultures and different voices at the table? I mean, how do you go about thinking about that challenge and safeguarding against the cultural translation?
For me, I think a team is the strongest way to go. And I think if you're not fortunate enough to have a big enough team to be diverse enough, I think that it comes down to every company that's doing business globally has a network in whatever country they're marketing to. So sometimes it may not be a marketing person, but if I can have a conversation with even an operations person on the ground in China, for example, they can tell me that, you know, my advertisements on WeChat aren't working. They can tell me that they don't understand this message. And the thing that I think some marketers make the mistake of is we start even communicating to ourselves. We understand what we mean, and so we think that everyone else understands what we mean. And, you know, one of the greatest lessons I've ever learned was the CEO of JetX, Adel Mardini, who I absolutely loved working for. One of the greatest things discussions that we had was around the branding colors. And the first colors that he had when I started were like a burnt yellow and black. And I asked him why he chose those two colors. And he said, it's not yellow, it's orange. And he said, but everyone thinks it's yellow. And I said, but it doesn't matter even if the Pantone says it's orange, number 241 or whichever one you want to say. If everyone perceives it to be yellow, it's yellow. And that's the first rule in marketing, is it doesn't matter what you're saying. It matters what's being perceived. And I think that had to be kept in there.
I think that's really true. I really love what you're saying there. I love your point about in marketing, perception is reality, that what the customer perceives is what the customer takes away in terms of their perception of the brand. And that is paramount. And I also love what you're saying in terms of, you know, you think you're doing global marketing, but really all you're doing is translating content. And if I've understood, I think what you're saying is that it's more than just the words, that every culture has its own idioms and it has its own stories and its relationship to colors and to just the way you sort of express your intent. And I wonder if you think it's possible to really understand that and appreciate that if you never actually go to different countries and do marketing in different places. You know, do you think you'd have had such a depth of understanding if you'd only stayed in America?
Honestly, I don't. But I think that would have been my own fault because there's so much information available. You can educate yourself really quick. And now the difference for me is that it was much more, I don't want to say in my face, like it was much more aware to me when I have people around me from all these different cultures that immediate I can get feedback. And when I'm doing a branding study for, you know, whether it's a new division or a new company or a new product, the first thing that I do is think of the ideas that I think of and what I understand. And then I take them to all of those people and I do not give them a background. I don't want them to know why the product does, what it does, how it does it. I don't want them to know anything. I want to see what they think from the message that I'm giving them. And I want to know what those colors mean to them. Because to me, green means sustainability and money. But in Chinese culture, it has a whole different relevance. And whether I use red, because you know, if I'm selling fuel, I definitely don't want to use the color red. But if I'm selling fuel in China, red is actually one of the most passionate colors, and it is what drives. And if you're talking about fueling, driving aviation, and passion driving your fueling, then you may want to tie that in and make sure that you aren't Amazing. Just communicating. They keep the Arabic in it, like in the name and everything else, but then it's always perceived from the outside as Dubai.
Yeah.
And to me, that's been, whoever's done that's done an excellent job. But I go back to, on the team side of it, it's easy to have, if you have the people and if you have the network, it's easy to use it. And sometimes I don't even use just my marketing team. Like I said, I'll contact someone on the ground because it's their opinion that counts in the end as well. I'm not marketing to other marketers. I'm marketing to operators and procurements and whoever my customer persona for that brand or that product is. So I want to make sure I'm getting that information. But if I were still in the U.S., I think that I would still be just translating content. I don't think I would even understand the difference in the images that I use and having someone's back turned to me, where in some ways that can be perceived as alluring, and then in some ways it can be perceived as disrespectful. Mm-hmm. And just those little nuances made a difference. And now when I do a press release for a company, I write the press release in English as my story, the passion that I want to tell.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I give it to a translation company, the first thing I tell them is, I do not want you to translate this. I want you to read the story, and I want you to tell me that story back in the way that you would say it, and then put that into your own local language so that the actual message is what's being conveyed, not just word for word.
I think that's really interesting. I think that, again, you know, perception is reality, and what you want them to perceive is the emotion. That, you know, they don't remember what you say, they remember how you make them feel. And I think that that's really interesting. But I wonder if there's another level of complexity to the challenge we're talking about. I think most people, you know, back in the UK where I'm from, or US where you're from, will understand that culture matters in not just the words being translated. So if you're going for a campaign which is going to both China and Russia and the US, then you want not just Google Translate, but you want something very significant in terms of relatedness to that culture. But if you were to be focusing a campaign on the UAE, for example, I mean, here you have about 90% of the people weren't born in the country, whereas in somewhere like the US, it's like 13%. And so you're still appealing to some degree, a monoculture, even if it's, you know, different in the US than it is in Russia. Whereas here you don't have that. It's atomized communities of different languages and different people. So how would you form a campaign? How would you go about conceiving of a campaign when you're going to one country that is itself consistent of so many different cultures and so many different demographics?
That is a really big challenge. And what's amazing is if you have a company that's big enough globally that you're advertising in all of the segments that you would have, it works out because you keep running those same advertisements. In Dubai, for example, there's a Chinese radio station now. So I can run the same ads on that Chinese radio station that I'm running in China as digital campaigns. And there's a station that speaks Urdu, and there's everything so that each one of those, I can still keep the content that I'm going for and work it. In Singapore, I found kind of a similar situation where there are so many expats there. It's very diverse, but it's still a completely different culture than the Middle East. I'm still marketing to Singapore, even to that vast group of expats, a totally different way than I market to the expats that are in the Middle East. I find the Singaporean mindset and everyone that's there very analytical, very business-minded. They want to talk about time savings. They want to talk about, you know, what benefits there are. Where in the Middle East market, even the expats, we start to get a little bit spoiled, and we're a little bit more worried about the details, the experience of it all, what that's going to mean, and how is this better than what I'm doing? What are you offering me that makes it a little bit more special? It's not always about price, I find, in the Middle East, even among all the different demographics. Most people will spend more if they find the experience is better. Where in Singapore, as much as they like quality and they demand quality, at the same time, usually it's budget that'll make a decision over, even if something's close enough in quality, they'll go with the price difference.
That makes sense. Another factor I wanted to ask you about was,
you know, you've alluded to the fact that when you come to the Middle East, like, you know, the 90% of the population are expats, you obviously have perceptions of the region and what it will be like to work in. And one of the factors that you must have thought about is obviously, you know, how you would build your career as a woman and you know, if that would be different to building your career elsewhere. And I just wonder what your experiences have been as a woman working in the Middle East.
That's been hands down the most transformative for me, and the reason why I think I love this country so much and I feel like it is my home. And I love the expats that move here that really feel a part of the UAE, and I think that the UAE's done a really good job to make everyone as happy as possible. But when I came here to work, I have to admit, my first stereotype, I thought that I would need to work in a Western company so that I would understand and be assimilated in some way. I didn't think I would have as much effect or power in an Arab country or in a company that was like a local company. And so for the first couple years, I worked with global companies that were, you know, based in the US or in the UK or wherever. And it was great. And I worked with such a vast group of people within the company that I actually got assimilated really quickly. But when I started working for actual local owned or local operated companies, I was really impressed. And one of the biggest examples I can give is at JetX. And my favorite story about that is that I had zero aviation experience. And the founder and CEO came to me and we talked about the position, and I was very honest with them. And I was like, you know, this is a whole new industry for me and I'm open to that challenge, but I need to make sure that you understand that there is, you know, learning curve in the beginning. And he agreed with me that the strengths of that were that I had a totally different perspective and that he's been in the industry. He has all the industry knowledge he needs. He needs someone that's going to bring the fresh new ideas. And I instantly felt that respect. And as a woman in the Middle East, I was really craving that from the beginning. And the greatest thing that I found second to that was that I've never felt in any way less than anyone here, male, female, culture, it didn't matter. I have always felt professionally respected and professionally my input counted, everything mattered. But then there was a different line for me that I don't know that many people can understand. I'm a single working mother. And in the US and in Europe, that would be a huge challenge, and that would actually be in a lot of ways negative, and it would be viewed negatively, and I would in most companies be missed for promotion unless it was a company trying to just hit a number for diversity and they needed one more woman in that position. Here, that decision isn't a choice. You can make that decision based on anyone you actually want to put in the position. So as a mother, I loved that when my son had a school production or when I needed to do something for my daughter, it was not looked at as, oh, she's got to miss work. It was, of course, your family comes first. Go do this, which gave me, in return, more respect and more loyalty to the company, and I worked even harder. So it worked on both sides. But then you fast forward, and after years of this, I felt that for the first time in my life as a professional woman, I was treated as both my role and as a woman. And I thought that that was absolutely amazing. And that's, I wish that more women understood that that's what life was like here. I actually feel in some ways I have it easier than men that are here, whether they're local or expats. I feel that instantly when a woman walks into a room, she's heard. I feel that instantly she's respected, and I feel that instantly it's considered. Yeah. And that's a huge, huge thing for me. When I tried to do a campaign around Women's Day in March, and so I called my HR and I asked them, I was like, look, you know, how many women do we have in the company and all this? The industry average for aviation globally if you take away crew jobs, is between 16 and 18%, which is a very, very low number. And I was impressed. We have no crew at the company that I was at, and we were 38% women, 40% in upper management at one point, including the only female head of fuel. And this was from a Middle Eastern company that could have hired anyone they wanted to hire for those roles. And when I asked the CEO if he, you know, this information, if he knew this, he was shocked. And that was, to me, that was the feminist equality win, is that he never once did that to increase the numbers. He did it because he hired who he thought was going to be the best for the job. And that's what I thought made it absolutely incredible. And fortunately, it hasn't been the only situation that I've been here for, and I've seen it over and over. So I'm actually really, really proud. And that's one of the messages I want to communicate from here, is how wonderful I think it is to be a working woman in the Middle East, and how completely against the stereotype it really is.
I think it's, as you say, a really important, really powerful message. And it's so interesting how few people miss it. And certainly when I speak to people back home who've never been over here, they don't realise, I think, especially for mothers, especially, it is in many ways so much easier to work here because nannies are affordable, the cost of childcare versus back home. And indeed, you know, that I think just a better respect for work-life balance and the importance of family makes it, for both men and women, but I suppose, you know, especially, you know, thinking about, you know, young working mums, you know, with young children. If you have two, three children, the cost of childcare in the UK and the US is just, I mean, it doesn't make sense to work sometimes, financial sense.
Completely. And not only that, but before, I used to come home, so I would get up in the morning, I would cook breakfast for my children, I'd make their school lunches, I'd wake them up, get them dressed, take them to school, then go to work, somehow figure out some after-school care, which was more expensive than my current nanny for a month for 2 hours a day, and then I would come home, usually around 6 or 7 in the evening. I'd still have to do grocery shopping, I'd still have to do cooking, I'd still have to clean, do the laundry for the next day, make the food, all of these things, which made me short with my children. Like, I didn't spend as much time with them. The time that I spent with them wasn't quality because I was yelling at them to get their homework done, or yelling at them to pick up clothes, or put this away, or do this. And so the 2 or 3 hours, the maximum that I saw them during a working day, wasn't even a good 2 to 3 hours. Now, in the morning, I do have help, and that's a huge advantage. And I've been lucky enough to have really good help that I've had for years. And we're in quite a great routine. So when I come home, my time away from work is spent focused on my child. It's not focused on, you know, doing homework together. We can do little projects, but a lot of that's already done. All of the laundry's done, the cooking's done, the cleaning's done. I'm spending time with him, enjoying him, which makes me not only a better mother, but then that in turn makes me a better employee as well, because I have more energy, I'm not as exhausted, I'm not as frustrated. It's, I mean, all the way around, it's such a better way of life. And then I feel that there are so many opportunities for families here, and there's so many things that you can do with your family that gives you such an enlightened experience, and you can see so many people out doing so many family activities. Everything's based around family.
Yeah, it's really incredible, and it's one of those things, stories doesn't get told often enough, I think, in terms of the benefits of living in a community like this. But, you know, and I appreciate now you are, you know, top of the tree, but sort of, you know, sending your mind back to when you were starting your career, you know, I think one of the really interesting things that I noticed about the beginning of your career is both the focus on academia and marketing qualifications, but also an early sort of venture into sort of, you know, the practical nature of how you start up a business and focus on that. And I just wonder, you know, in terms of the advice you might give to young men, young women sort of starting out their sort of journey, looking to sort of follow in your footsteps, should they focus more on academia, more on sort of, you know, should they start up their own business, they're going to university, and what are the sort of the advice you'd give them?
I have a very unique perspective. I actually never wanted to go to university, even back in the day when I went. And I'm fortunate that I went, and I'm fortunate that I was pushed to go, because had I not gone, I don't think I would have had the opportunities that I've had. However, when I got my degree, it was a completely different time. And not to say how old I am, but to admit that internet was not an option. Google was not around. We weren't even emailing in school. It was, everything was still very much done by hand. And so all of the things that I learned with my degree were amazing at the time, but are completely irrelevant now. There's literally nothing that I use currently that I used then, other than color palettes and exercises like that, which to me now, all of this information is readily available. And like I said, it's all about immersing yourself in the culture and in everything else. And now I think that for my own children, if they want to go to university, I'm more than happy for them to go. But I don't necessarily prioritize it in any way. And I don't think that it's needed for a lot of careers. And I actually think that it can be detrimental to kids starting out that end up in debt, you know, in some countries for going to school, and then end up in a trade where they're not able to even pay off that debt. That to me just is absolutely ridiculous. I love entrepreneurs a lot, and I think that that's amazing. However, I definitely disagree with the amount of focus that's being placed on entrepreneurship, that that's the only way to be successful, especially when it comes to women in business. That seems to be the push, the message. And I don't think you have to be successful to be an entrepreneur. I tried entrepreneurship myself. I've been told since I was young that was my strength, that you were either an entrepreneur or you were a business person. And I actually think that there's a person in the middle. I think I have a very entrepreneurial mindset, but I think that no one is good at everything. And when you're starting a company, most people are starting off small with small budgets, and that means that operations, finances, HR, marketing, all of those things fall on you. And I don't really know anyone that's good at all of those things. I think that there are people that are proficient at a few of those things, but maybe only good at one or two. And when I went down the entrepreneurship road, I learned quick and hard that I know my strengths. I'm great at what I do, but, and as a matter of fact, I did so well at my strength that I marketed myself out of business. I couldn't keep up with the demand because I didn't understand the supply. I didn't understand the scalability, because those are all decisions that have never been in my realm. Those have all been done by financial officers and procurement officers and operational support that I've had at all these huge companies. And when it was just me, I'm not good at that. And I definitely won't be doing that in the future. I really think you have to look at yourself hard. And I think you have to be really honest with yourself. I think partnerships are better than a straight entrepreneur, where you rely on someone else. Or if you're the entrepreneur that has the Richard Branson mindset of that will hire people that he says are smarter than him, because he knows that they'll do that job and get it done. If you can be that, then yes, go for the entrepreneurship road. Be your own boss. It's not for me, and I really hope that it's not continued to be shoved down people's throat, as that's the only way to be successful. There are great opportunities. I would love to be CMO at Coca-Cola. That would be, for me, that would be the pinnacle of my career over me having a really successful small business on my own.
Yeah, I think it's really important. Just as it's wrong to say everyone needs highest academic achievement in order to be successful, it's also wrong in today's world to say everyone needs to have set up their own business and, you know, and sold and whatever it might be. And I think what you're talking about really resonates with the whole kind of entrepreneurial movement, the whole idea that we don't need to be entrepreneurs, but if you've got that entrepreneurial mindset, you can be an entrepreneur and you can bring that mindset to within the business, and you can be the virus that infects the host. You can transform the business from within. And I just wonder if you can think of an example of how your sort of entrepreneurial mindset has actually how you've taken that to different businesses or different companies you've worked with and helped to give them fresh perspective on what they do.
For me, yeah, actually, and that's where I think my biggest strength is, and I now we talk about it as strategy, but before that, I think that it was being in a company, and I think marketing people are so passionate. And I think that as soon as you start with a company, you really start to drink the Kool-Aid, as they say. You start to buy into everything. You want to believe all the messaging, all the good. And you're writing all of this, and you start to realize, okay, every place there's gaps. Okay, how can we fill these gaps? How can I make this better? And when I worked for Quintessentially, I love the brand. I think it's just incredible. And being a UK company, they do business very much the way that they do business in London, all over the world. And in some ways, that's their success, and in some ways, it's a downfall. And in the Middle East, it was definitely an obstacle, because here, you're not that far away from anything you actually need. You can always get a little bit of pull with someone to get the table you need, and the benefits that you would need in London or in New York or in Shanghai, you can pretty much pull here. So that was an obstacle, but at the same time, one of the things that I realized with them is that they had these unbelievable resource for data. They, to service their clients, they're taking down every single detail, and everything is noted on conversations, how many children you have, when their birthdays are, what you're allergic to, what's your favorite steak, what's your favorite restaurant, when do you normally eat? All of these things are tagged. So to me, I saw the opportunity that using these analytics could build loyalty programs for other businesses. Instead of focusing on the person-to-person lifestyle management model, that if we were going to other companies and if we were saying to them, listen, we'll help you understand your customer better, the customer that you want to keep, the customer that you want to reach out to, by finding out what their tags are. What do they like? Where do they travel? Where do they vacation? How are they paying for these vacations? Is it credit card? Is it cash? Do they only travel in the summer? Do they travel to the same place back and forth every time? Or are they adventurous? Once we looked at that and we sold to our first client, and when we did that, they gave us 100 of their top clients. And these were the 100 people that they needed to retain the most. And so each one of these people had their own lifestyle manager that would just do their request. After a year, we were able to go back to the business and tell them, okay, out of these top 100, this is how many of them requested airport transfers. If 80% of them request that, that's a benefit you need to have in your program. Okay, 20% of them booked hotels all the time, like and always booked these three brands. So these are the strategic partnerships that we want to line up on this side. And then it was building that program and finding a completely new way to do business, which didn't change any of our operations. It was just a new way to market our services and a new way for them to be utilized by someone else. And that, to me, was one of the most fun projects and one of the most rewarding, because for once, I actually got to be a little bit more analytical and see sides and then build a program that I saw work for another company, and I thought it was amazing. And then they started rolling it out globally since then.
That's a great story. I really love that. You know, and you're talking about sort of, you know, the 100 lifestyle managers. It resonates with sort of the concept of the concierge MVP in Eric Ries-Selin's startup, where you can kind of get qualitative insights before you actually build the service, or with that before you have sort of release the membership service. Really try and understand. And I think also data is a good example of what you were saying earlier, in terms of probably wasn't a big part of your marketing degree, and yet now it's a huge part of what we actually do as practitioners in marketing.
And it has to be. And now, I mean, that's, to me, one of my biggest successes is there's some marketing activities that you have a very clear ROI and you can see it immediately. And then there are some that are brand awareness and engagement that you don't quite have the clear visibility on. But the most amazing thing to me is that when you look at that from what it was 20 years ago to what it is now, I can clearly reduce budgets and show my impact, where I think a lot of marketing a long time ago, you couldn't. It was literally just putting an ad in a magazine, hoping that the right people saw it. You're still marketing to a bunch of people that don't need to see it, but okay, and spending the money and never really knowing what it was getting, because the only thing that mattered was the bottom line. And you didn't know if that was coming from marketing, or did you have a really, really strong sales department? There was no way to tell. Now, I know how much of my marketing is coming from the sales team going out and person to person, having meetings, versus leads coming in digitally from advertising sources and different things. So now I think that that means that marketing is so much more a part of the overall business strategy. Instead of it being a support function as it used to be, I actually think that marketing is what's driving everything. And I think that you need, I think sales and marketing have always been aligned. You know, everyone thinks that those two departments, and in some ways I've seen people that think that they're together, and I clearly don't. I think they're very separate divisions. But I also think that marketing now needs to be much more involved with IT departments, much more involved with operations departments. It doesn't mean anything if I can sell you a message that I can't deliver. I need to understand every single piece of this. And now with digital, it's got good and bad. The great thing is that you have the opportunity to reach anybody at any time, anywhere, quickly, and usually not that expensively. But the problem with that is then everyone can do it. And so now there's all of this content everywhere, and it's this ocean of content. And a lot of it is strived towards, you know, certain target individuals. How do you then decipher the message that will actually reach them and garner engagement or attention from them? And that's where I think marketing is critical for companies now.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of big companies, like, to use Coca-Cola as an example, I use it a lot when I'm meeting with new CEOs, especially in the Middle East, where I think that, and I won't say just in the Middle East, but in the Middle East, and I'm going to lump in Europe in this one too. I think a lot of people still view marketing as a side and not as a critical component to their success. And when I was forced to get my degree, my father told me right off the bat, you either get a marketing degree or a business degree, because if you don't know how to operate a business, you'll fail. And if you don't know how to market a business, you'll fail. If you're the best doctor in the world, but no one knows about you, you'll still fail. And I really wish companies would realize that it's this function is not where you cut when you're struggling.
Yeah.
Like, this is where you actually take the risk for the reward of hoping to save yourself.
Yeah, look, 100%. I mean, we call this podcast CX for CA because we believe that, you know, customer experience leads to competitive advantage, and especially true in a much more digital world, that it's not just having the efficiency of knowing the medicine or the supply chain or whatever it might be. You know, the ability to get consumers to choose you is directly correlated to the power of your marketing and the customer experience you offer. And to kind of to build that out in terms of a response you had to a previous question a moment ago, you also talked about going into the aviation industry without knowledge of the aviation industry. And I wanted to sort of, you know, test that in view of what you were just saying in terms of the importance of marketing. I mean, what was that challenge like? And I mean, for example, in your past, you'd worked in cosmetics. I mean, I couldn't think of two more divergent products to market than a lipstick and a private aeroplane. I mean, are those marketing skills really transferable? I mean, you know, talk to me about the importance of industry specific knowledge to the marketer.
I think that's actually my favorite question, because I have worked in a lot of industries, and you know, beauty and cosmetics being one of them. I was fortunate enough to work for Dermalogica, which was a huge global brand. I've worked in real estate in the US. I've worked in the quintessentially concierge lifestyle bit, travel and tourism, luxury products, Aston Martin and Bentley. All of these have been completely different. And then going into private aviation has really opened my eyes to the amount of how much industry doesn't matter to someone willing to learn. And there is a bridge. I think that if you have all of the industry knowledge, and if you've been in the same industry for 20 years, that's fantastic. But are you completely opening yourself up to new ideas? Are you looking at what's being done in other places and how that could benefit you? I see in the Middle East a lot, especially around like banking, especially around aviation, the marketing is done within that industry and it's all the same people doing it. So it's not reaching a new level. Where you look in the US, one of the head CMOs for Bank of America had actually come from a completely different field. I believe it was a fast food chain. And everyone was kind of in shock. Well, no, when you go to school for marketing, you don't study an industry. You learn how to market. And I think as you get older and as you get better at that job, I appreciate campaigns done by Nike. I've never worked in the athletics field or in the sportswear field, but I can still use ideas from them to do a really inspirational campaign on private aviation fuel because I want that passion in it. And so to me, I think that that's actually something really negative is if you stay within that industry, if you bring someone else out and your target clients are usually not in your industry. And to give you an example, in private aviation, everyone thinks that you're marketing to the passenger in the plane. Very rarely is it that passenger that's making the decisions when it comes to which airport they're landing at. If there's a city like Paris where there's multiple private terminals, do they really care which one, or do they let the pilot make the decision, or do they let the management company make the decision because of the costing? So my customer personas were the passenger in the plane, which is the 1% of the 1%, but then it was also a procurement guy, and then it was an operator, and then it was a pilot. And so I had to run campaigns that were targeted towards them. And when you look at a lipstick, it's the exact same thing. You have to look at that lipstick and go, okay, how do I reach the market that is gonna want this lipstick? Is my product, is it Fenty Beauty by Rihanna? Is it more of a trendy product? Is it more like geared towards, you know, younger demographics? Is it got brighter colors? Is this more of a Clinique, which is more clean and simple? Like, is this geared more towards this 30 plus audience? And this is how I'm gonna reach them. To me, it's all about educating yourself not only on what you are marketing, but on that target audience and looking at what other products and services they use that resonate with them and how you can be inspired by the same marketing practices so that it almost naturally goes into them.
Yeah. And I think in some ways, by definition, the people least qualified to see the company and the product as customers see it are the people who work in that company, work in that industry, because they are by definition insiders. So it's harder for them to have empathy with the new customer, the prospect, or than anyone else. And so I suppose that's part of what you're saying marketing brings. And I think that's it's an incredibly strong case for the role of marketing and to have a seat at the table. I mean, when you were going through your sort of, you know, your logos and brands and incredible organizations and products you've worked with, many of them were focused on the kind of the more luxury, more high net worth individual sort of end of the market. I wonder if you can say a little bit of something about how your tactics and strategies change when you're focused on high net worth individuals.
Completely. That market, to me, is the hardest to market to because they're being sold all the time. Everybody wants their money. Everybody wants their attention. And when you look at them, you think of, okay, if I get, they're like the big fish, you know, in every industry, the people that are gonna spend the most. And when you're looking for these high net worth individuals, usually you don't get to be a high net worth individual because you don't know how to manage your money and you don't look for smart deals. Usually you're gonna be pretty astute. So I think transparency in marketing is number one for them. I think number two is educating them. It's not about the flash. It's about showing them why they need this. And I think one of the biggest mistakes that a lot of people make when it comes to marketing luxury is they think it has to be luxury in the sense of champagne and caviar and China, when in actuality, luxury for some people can be time. If I'm saving you an hour a day, that may be the luxury that you want more than anything else. And when I looked at marketing, especially like for private aviation, when we were trying to market to these people, in the US, there's a very specific negative marketing. If you talk about champagne and caviars and luxury terminals and Rolls Royces and everything else, it's actually a negative. They see it as frivolous and they don't see it as useful. They want to see that the reason that their CEO and vice president are taking a private jet is because it made them able to hit 3 meetings in one day versus taking 3 days to go to these cities and come back, and that it was a practical, smarter expense, and that they were able to work on the plane, that they weren't wasting time in terminals. And so you have to look at it from completely different standpoints, where in the Middle East, same demographic, same everything else. Yes, they care about the time savings, but will they land at my terminal if there's an option better? No. If there's an option that is absolutely better, just looking better, feeling better, that's where they want to be. And that's what you have to, goes back to, again, studying that region and knowing the people that you're marketing to within that segment and in that area. I think it's amazing to me the differences in all the places. Privacy is a huge issue in the US. In the UAE, it hasn't been as much. I haven't had anyone that only travels private jet because it's private. I think they're perfectly happy to have people there seeing them getting on and off a private jet. Sports teams would land and everything else, and you could tell by the post that they didn't mind it being that private at the time. Where in the US, that was a critical component, was that you could guarantee that no one would see them, no one would bother them, no one would touch them.
And I have to ask quickly about the cappuccino campaign that went viral. I wonder if you can, many people have probably seen it, but I wonder if you can explain about that.
For me, it goes back to customer experience and marketing. And it goes back to how you personalize that customer experience and then how that translates into a marketing tool. And again, when you're dealing with ultra, ultra high net worth individuals, they have everything. They have access to everything. They're being marketed everything. So anyone can get them anything that they want. What can you get them that captures their attention? And I was really lucky. Actually, one of the members of my team found this cappuccino printer. And it was the most amazing thing. And for 3,000 euros, we bought this cappuccino printer and we brought it to the terminal. And I think that the CEO was a little bit questioning. I don't think he was 100% sold on it. And the first time we printed one of our clients' faces...
It's actually on the foam of the cappuccino.
On the foam of a cappuccino, any foamy beverage, latte. As soon as we printed
other beverages available.
And delivered it on there, the look was it. I knew that we had something really good. So flash forward a couple months, and we had an amazing opportunity to be a part of the Misfits movie, which is coming out, I think, in March. And so as they were shooting in the terminal, Pierce Brosnan, one of my absolute all-time favorite actors.
James Bond.
And yeah. And now that I actually got to spend, I wouldn't say a lot of time, but some time with him, he's actually one of the most amazing just people in general. And there are a lot of celebrities I've met that are great, but there are very few that surpass what I hope of them, and he definitely does. But when he was in the terminal, we made him a cup of coffee, and we put his photo on the front and we brought it to him. And instantly, he posted it on his social media for us. It was not a paid post, it was an advertisement. Posted it on his social media for us, and it ended up with over 1.7 million views. It was put on TMZ, it was listed in newspapers, and the greatest thing was, in every one of those, they were mentioning that at the JetX terminal, Pierce Brosnan had gotten his own personalized coffee. Adam Levine posted it as well and put that he finally knew that he made it when his face was on a cup of coffee. And these little things were literally, the cost of that to us was so, so, so minimal. But the exposure with the people that posted it, and not just the celebrities, I mean, celebrities had the amazing following and that's what made it an unbelievable thing, but even just the VP of a charter company that posted it, that then their client saw, that made a huge deal. And I have people that now come to the terminal and request, you know, the cup of coffee, like that's what they've come there for. And that's one of the things where it's a money can't buy it experience. It's something that they didn't expect, that they know. Now it's up the bar though of what we're going to do next.
That's brilliant. It speaks to those little moments and how create something special and justifies so much in terms of their choice. So I have one final question for you. If you've heard any of the other interviews, you know that I'm fascinated by this question that once got asked to the physicist Richard Feynman, who was asked, he was obviously knew a lot about science, a lot about physics, and he was once asked, if all the sum total of scientific knowledge were wiped away and you had the opportunity to only pass on one piece of knowledge, one insight to the next generation so that they could rebuild that scientific knowledge, what would that be? And for him, that was about things are comprised of atoms. And I suppose, so the question I commonly ask is around, you know, thinking about all of the experiences you've had and, you know, summing it up, and, you know, if you could only pass on one thing, one sort of insight, one sort of central insight about what you've learned to help and inspire others, what would that insight be?
Do nothing without passion. To me, every success I've ever had has been through the passion that I've had for the project, the company, the person, the place, in every way. And that's essential. And I never want that to be lost. I think that that's the greatest gift of anybody.
And which is fantastic advice. And what's next for you in terms of what are you going to be passionate about in the future?
I'm passionate about a lot of things. My number one focus is actually I want to somehow open up opportunities where I can really educate people more on the Middle East, especially Western cultures and companies, so that people are actually investing in the Middle East and seeing this for the opportunity that it is. I want more women that do own companies or that are heads of companies. I want them to come over. I want them to work from here and be all that they can be, because I think that this environment allows that so much. And then I also want to not only continue to build that, but from my own personal point of view, I want to continue to work with companies that are so passionate, that need just that little bit of help to communicate what they do so well, and that have been maybe in the same environment for a while and just haven't grown, because there's nothing more exciting to me than seeing companies really take shape and really get the notice that they deserve, especially when they're founded on the right values, when they have the right services, when they've really put everything together. So I really want to continue that. But my main focus is on working women in the Middle East, both local and expat as well, because I think there's a lot of women in the Middle East that are local women that are doing amazing work that I don't feel is being communicated outside enough for people to really understand and start using that as a model.
Absolutely. I think it's a fantastic way to end and a great cause to be passionate about. And if people want to reach out to you, what's the easiest way? LinkedIn, or what's the best way to find you?
LinkedIn is my favorite.
Yep.
for sure. But also, I'm launching my own company on Valentine's Day because, again, I don't believe you should do anything without love and passion. And since that is the most passionate day of the year, I'm spending it this year on this company. So they can definitely follow the brand Rockets on Instagram and they'll learn a lot more.
Awesome. You've been absolutely fantastic. And it's been so interesting to listen to you and so informative. I'm really glad we did this. Thank you very much for your time.
No, thank you guys for having me. I really, really appreciate it. And I hope that a lot of people get some advice. And I really hope that there's anything more I can do that they know.
Awesome. That was fantastic. Thank you very much.